So we crown the Monster Energy King of Brands, and in doing so, we may well have awoken a monster. Welcome to episode 70 of Bike Life. Let's go! Yes, to warm welcome everybody, this is episode 70 of Bike Life here on Motorsport 101 as we look back on the Summer Brands Hatch GP round of the British Superbike Championship as Josh Brooks moved into British Superbike Championship contention with his first two wins of 2018 and with it crowned himself the King of Brands for another year. We'll talk about how he did it and whether he is genuinely now a legitimate championship challenger as we head into the late summer. We'll talk about the other big stories from this weekend as Glenn Irwin also announced himself as a title challenger heading into the remainder of the season. Leon Haslam went winless for the first time since Easter, and all the other big stories as the showdown picture starts to become a lot more clearer, although not for everybody, particularly if your name is Bradley Ray. We'll also bring you the big news of the week, which also surrounds the British Superbike Championship leader Leon Haslam. He won't be racing in Britain regularly next year. And we will look ahead to this weekend. And I know what you're thinking. There's no MotoGP. There is no World Superbikes. There is no BSB this weekend. But fear not. It's only the biggest single motorcycle race on earth this weekend. The Suzuka 8-Hour brings the curtain down on the Endurance World Championship. And the Japanese manufacturers are breaking out the big guns for this one. Joining me once again to look back on what happened last weekend and look ahead to what's coming this weekend, it's Andre Harrison. Welcome, Dre.
Welcome to the all-star game of bike races. And it's a fun time for all involved. I hear Leon Haslam is favourite to win the three-point shootout later this weekend. But yeah, a great weekend of action at Brands and probably the biggest individual bike race of the year now at Suzuka coming up this weekend. I have fully recovered from my awful German GP experience, and normal service will definitely be resumed, probably.
Yeah, we've already had plenty of Monster Energy and general energy drink references already, but I think we're going to need plenty of it to get through the early hours of Sunday morning and watch the 8-Hour, which is live in its entirety across Eurosport. But first of all, let's tell you about the various places you can find us, and that starts with Facebook, facebook.com/motorsport101. On Twitter, we're at motorsport_101. On YouTube, it's youtube.com/motorsport101. And a couple of things to see on there right now. You can also find the first of our watch parties for a historic Formula One race this week. Dre and selected others watched the 2005 Japanese Grand Prix. So if you're a Kimi fan, and I know there are some of you out there, you can tune into that on our YouTube channel right now. You can also find a sneak preview, if you haven't listened to the whole thing yet, of episode 152 of Motorsport 101. As Dre vents his spleen on the current situation of Formula One fandom. More on that in a second. Our website is motorsport101.com, where you can find written content and all of the information about both of our weekly shows. And if you want to listen to those weekly shows earlier than everyone else, backing us on Patreon will enable you to do that. Backing us at the $5 level at patreon.com/motorsport101 will earn you early access to both of our weekly shows. Backing us at the $10 level will earn you access to the very Discord server that we are recording on right now, and will enable you to listen to these shows live as they happen. As I mentioned, this week saw the recording of episode 152 of Motorsport 101. And I have to say, Dre, I know this must have been a difficult one for you to record. And as I was watching bits of the German Grand Prix on Sunday, because I was at work at the time, I'd not convinced a friend of mine, more he'd taken it upon himself, based on what I'd said to him the night before, to place money on Sebastian Vettel to win the world championship this year.
Christ.
Because I told him in the car as we went to play pool on the Saturday night, Lewis Hamilton is not winning the world championship this year, Sebastian Vettel is. So he went to put some money on it. So that was at the forefront of my mind. But the other thing that was in my mind when I saw Vettel buried to the wall is, God, what on earth are you going to say on the podcast this week?
Oh, there's those that I got nothing for you on this one. It wasn't an easy episode, I'll say that much. I think that is kind of a given, knowing where my allegiances lie. Yes, episode 152, Just Add Water, will be out by the time this goes out in its entirety. And yeah, as you can imagine, it was all centered around the German Grand Prix and arguably the most entertaining batshit Grand Prix of the year, and there's been a few contenders for that already this season. Again, as I said on during the show itself, it's this F1 season has been, pardon me, surprisingly great so far. Genuinely 5 or 6 good to great races out of 11 so far. And this was no exception. A race that, look, and especially in the second half, had everything. Team orders controversies on 2 separate occasions. Rain during a race for the first time this season as well. And of course, that wreaked havoc with the running order. Lewis Hamilton very nearly getting, you know, a time penalty that would have cost him the victory as he, you know, failed to cross the pit entry line without going into the pit. That was another controversy in its own right. So, yeah, this was a crazy race by all accounts, and it had just about everything you can imagine in it. And we break it all down on Motorsport 101, from Lewis Hamilton somehow winning from 14th on the grid, Sebastian Vettel and the curse of Hockenheim that he will seemingly never be able to lift, no matter how hard he tries. Valtteri Bottas giving a team order not to challenge his teammate at the end. Kimi Raikkonen giving a team order from the lead to let his teammate through. It's all sorts of mayhem. Even Brendan Hartley getting in the points and Charles Leclerc having a perfect pirouette. It was that sort of race weekend. All of that on episode 152. Available now for your listening pleasure. And as mentioned as well on the YouTube channel, our first watch party is up as well on the 2005 Japanese Grand Prix. One for you Kimi Raikkonen fans out there as well. A very, very fun time indeed. 3, in my opinion, of some of the greatest overtakes you will ever see in that Grand Prix. A fantastic race. Well worth the watch. We'll be back next week for that with the 2012 Brazil Grand Prix, that title decider next week. So that's another classic. Some guy called Nico Hülkenberg very nearly won a Grand Prix. More on that next week. But episode 152, available now for your listening pleasure.
Yeah, don't talk about the guy that nearly won the Grand Prix, Dre. Talk about the guy that did win it. But his last
talk about won. Jensen Button more.
Don't worry, listeners, I'm working on trying to get Dre to watch the closing stages of the 2011 Canadian Grand Prix with me, but I'm having a difficult time of it at the moment.
Do you value our friendship, Lewis?
I value one of Jensen Button's greatest ever wins, but I never tire of watching that. Anyway, let's talk about bikes before Civil War breaks out on Bike Live. Usually happens when Bex is here. But yeah, let's talk about Brands Hatch last weekend. The next round of the British Superbike Championship as they head into the summer. And we're getting into moving time, as we said last week on this show, where showdown spots are starting to be decided. And we're getting a much clearer picture of who are the likely contenders for the British Superbike Championship this season. Leon Haslam, of course, went into the weekend with a comfortable championship lead. And obviously, given how comfortable it was, he's still left with one. But the weekend, Dre, belonged to Josh Brooks. And he kind of teed this up at the start of the weekend that he was going to shave his moustache off if he did the double, which obviously must have, just at that point alone, he must have thought there was a chance of it for him to say such a thing. So it proved a brilliant double victory. Not that either win was particularly comfortable. But as I said at the top of the show, it almost felt like a monster was waking up at Brands Hatch last weekend, because we've seen what Josh Brooks is capable of once he gets going in a British Superbike season. And it looks like he and McCann's Yamaha, after steadily improving as the season's gone on, we saw signs of it, didn't we, a few rounds ago, that they were getting the hang of it and they were improving that R1. It looks like they finally put it together and it all clicked at Brands.
Shades of 2015 all over again, doesn't it? That's kind of how it felt like to me watching that weekend take place. I said on last week's show at the end, I felt like Josh Brooks had a really good chance of taking the double here. I had a hunch he would, and did. He's always gone well around here. He loves Brands Hatch. He's always gone well, especially around the Grand Prix layout. He's won several times there in the past. It was the first time, and he was at the tag team last year. That was the weekend where Brooks truly felt like he was a title contender for me. You know, running and challenging Shaky and Haslam for the wins on both occasions, and then he crashed in one of the two races in the middle of the season there. But Brooks was super. Has always been super strong around here, and yeah, if McCam's getting better, it just seems that. Yeah, this was going to be the weekend where if McCams was going to make a footprint in this championship, it felt like this was going to be the weekend to do it. And yeah, both their riders rode very, very well indeed, but especially Brooks, who held off Glenn Irwin on both occasions and, you know, did it very, very well indeed.
Yeah, Josh Brooks was keen to point out that, you know, a lot of people obviously wanted to point out the similarities between this and 2015, where his double win at Brands Hatch GP in 2015 were his first wins of the entire season. And then he went on to win all but three races in what remained of the season and went on to win that championship. The first time ever that the showdown hasn't even gone to the final round of the season, with Brooks wrapping it up a round early. So he was keen to point out that just because the same situation has happened this year with his first wins coming at Brands doesn't mean he's going to go on to dominate again this year. But it is a reflection of the format, isn't it, Dre? That even though Leon Haslam sits on 242 points and has some 112 points more than Josh Brooks at the moment, in terms of the outright championship as a whole going towards the end of the season, Josh Brooks suddenly does look every bit a genuine title contender. And I think it's a little bit different, isn't it, as well, with Jake Dixon, who also took his first win of the season. Last time out at Knockhill, we looked at Jake and thought, is this the start of a guy who's going to become a genuine title threat late in the season? With Josh Brooks, the difference is, we know he can do it.
And let's not forget one important thing about the showdown format. What track do they race around three times at the end of the season?
This one.
Brands Hatch. If he's taken the double here, he'll be thinking about the treble at the end of the season, and you know that could be 75 points, and that could make all the difference in the world when we actually get to Brands Hatch at the end of the season. And Haslam is a guy that tends to struggle a little bit around Brands Hatch, and he's not had the easiest of times around there as well. So yeah, when you weigh it all up like that, it's something where I could see why MCN went out of its way this week to, you know, to hail tribute to Brooks and to, you know, pencil him in now as a title contender going forward. It makes a lot of sense for him to do that, because like I said, the way the showdown format is a format that he's dominated in the past, and the fact it's a signature round he's really good at, where, you know, he can win all three races there. And if he does that, then he's bound to be a threat. You put the pressure back on Haslam to basically hold par, which is something, you know, he tried to do last year and he just about failed on, unfortunately, even before the brake failure. That was, you know, in race three. So, yeah, I get it. It totally makes sense. Where that's concerned, where Brooks is being held as a title threat, like I could certainly see it, for sure.
And what's key as well is that the McCams Yamaha team and Brooks both seem to be improving as the year goes on. But if they keep that going, they're not going to get any weaker from where they are now. They're going to continue to challenge at the front. And the important thing for Brooks now is he has to consider himself a title challenger. I'm sure he does, because he is going to make the showdown the way he's going. Even though he's not mathematically certain at the moment. So the task for him now is to close down the podium points gap, which at the moment Haslam would go into the showdown were it to start now with a 22-point lead, and that would be over Jake Dixon, not over Brooks. Brooks would be a further 5 points back, so he'd be 27 off the lead, which is a race worth of points. And I don't think anyone can afford to go into the showdown, no matter how good they are, a full race worth behind Haslam, because Haslam's probably going to be able to manage that through the showdown, because you don't think Haslam's going to go through the showdown winless, do you?
No.
So you're going to have to close that gap before we get there. But, yeah, again, we just know with Brooks, don't we, what he's capable of in terms of taking a title before. And just the general confidence that the guy has around him. I mean, Brooks has never been shy of an opinion, has he?
No.
In British Superbikes or just in general on social media. But you just tend to get a swagger about him, don't you? When Josh Brooks is at his best and when Josh Brooks is confident, you notice it. You don't just notice it off the bike, but you notice it off it. And a confident, dare I say it, not overconfident, but a very confident / arrogant Josh Brooks is a formidable adversary for anybody, isn't he?
He absolutely is. I mean, you hit the nail on the head for me. Like, he's extremely charismatic. He's extremely opinionated. You know, you can make the stereotype jokes about him being Australian. You know, it's in his nature. He's very Australian, and you know, he comes out with controversial things. He's not afraid to speak his mind, and you know, he's certainly not afraid of confidence, and he is a rider that's very much based in confidence. If the bike struggles, Brooks tends to struggle. If the bike is clued in, Brooks is as good as anybody in BSB when the bike is working. And he reminds me a lot of Jorge Lorenzo in that sense. He's a very much a confidence-based sort of rider. So when the bike is clicking, like we saw at Brands this weekend, he's incredibly hard to beat. Glenn Owen threw the house at him in both races, and both times Brooks was unassailable. He just could not find a way around it. Yeah. Brooks was flawless under pressure. And Brands is a circuit where there are certain overtaking opportunities. So Owen threw the house at it, wasn't able to make it work. And yeah, like when Brooks is plugged in, look out. He's a very, very hard man to beat.
He is, and he's moved up to fourth, as I mentioned, in the overall points at the moment. And yeah, with still, let's count them up, there are still 7 races to go before we decide our showdown 6. But Brooks is up to 130 points, so you probably think he's going to need another 40, 50 points maybe to get himself in.
I think with Haslam being so dominant, I think the bar comes down a little bit. I think 150 should be enough to get you over the line this time around, I reckon.
But yeah, we reckon if he gets to sort of 170, 180, he's guaranteed to be in.
Oh, God, absolutely. Yeah.
So Brooks, another win or two will get him in. But as I mentioned, I think Brooks has probably got bigger fish to fry than that. He wants to win the whole thing, and I think he needs to keep winning, or at least keep racking up the podium points to ensure that he goes into the showdown when he gets there with some sort of chance up against Haslam, who's been so good for much of the season. You mentioned Glenn Irwin, who is one spot ahead of Brooks in the championship. He's on 145 points in third, and also as good as certain to be in the showdown unless he gets injured between now and the end. Not quite the win that he was hoping for, because he has won before. He won in the wet last year, did Glenn Irwin. But it's his first ever double rostrum on a British Superbike weekend. And with every passing British Superbike weekend that goes by, Dre, we continue to sort of ask the question to ourselves, is Irwin ready to take on leadership of this BYZ Ducati team in the absence of Shaky Bird? And with every passing weekend, he's answering the questions.
He absolutely is. Yeah, like I said, this is the first double rostrum, and I think like the last 2 or 3 weekends, he's shown that top fives are now an expectation for Glenn Irwin rather than just a minor surprise. And again, for a rider that doesn't have a Wikipedia page, he's certainly riding very, very well this season. Again, like, you know, both races, a fraction behind Brooks over the line. He tried everything he could to get around Brooks in both races, just didn't have enough in him. But the Ducati's not going away. Glenn Irwin is third in the championship for good reason. He's been there or thereabouts almost every weekend, especially since Alton Park. I mean, he's had a couple of iffy races here and there, but with the format we have right now, that's okay. That's absolutely fine. I mean, a few more podium credits here or there really wouldn't hurt going into the showdown format, because everybody 12, else around man. Him. Yeah, the problem is with that, because everybody else around him has wins. Bradley Ray has 2 wins. Josh Brooks now has 2 wins. Dixon has a win and had 5 consecutive podium results. Actually, 6 consecutive podium results in the middle of the season.
Glenn Irwin has had 4 podiums this year, and they've all been second places.
Yeah, he's been banging on the door for quite some time, and he goes well round Brands as well this year. You know, especially in race 2, he was very strong around the Indy layout, very nearly beat Haslam, and probably just showed his hand a little bit too early on that one, and it just didn't quite work out. But again, like, Irwin is now becoming a really, really good all-rounder in this series now. And hey, if Shaky doesn't come back, Ducati still has a very, very solid overall team leader to build the team around going forward, because Glenn Irwin is quickly becoming a guy who can win any given race in this series now.
And he's also had someone to celebrate last weekend. He did take his first ever British Superbike pole position last weekend, yeah, with an outright lap record around the Brands GP circuit as well. Of course, it's the first ever pole that he's taken on a Saturday, because sometimes you can take a pole by setting the fastest lap in race 1. But in terms of a qualifying pole position, that's the first for Glenn Irwin. And he says himself now, he believes he can fight for the British Superbike title now. He says the target of Brands was to close the podium points gap, and we've done that. Now we can fight for wins. And he says, of course, it would have been lovely to get the win, but we got our first pole. There are more than 2 people in this title fight, and it's going to be close. And he believes he can fight for it. And the Ducati is clearly still a very, very capable bike, as he's proving at the moment in this championship. And as I mentioned, he's a very strong rider in the wet as well. So if we get any wet races, which the longer into the season we go, the more likely they'll become.
Another confidence guy.
Another confidence guy, another charismatic guy. He's once you can actually sort of work out what he's saying with the very strong Ulster accent that he has, he is a great guy to listen to. He's going to be a fun rider to watch as the season goes on, because as Dre says, he doesn't have a confidence problem. Does Glenn Irwin. Nor does Leon Haslam, it has to be said, who's been the nearest guy to him in the British Superbike Championship. Well, basically, no one's really been near to him in championship terms this year. But this is the first time, Dre, that he's gone winless since the opening round at Donington in the snow, where, of course, Bradley Ray did the double. Leon Haslam pointed out after the race that he felt his bike, his Kawasaki, was losing out a lot to the Yamaha and the Ducati on the straights of Brands GP. Now, it's far be it for Leon Haslam to be worried at one weekend where he doesn't win, because he still had 2/3. But surely the fact that we race around this circuit 3 more times at the end of the year, surely this is not a circuit where we'll want that Kawasaki to have such a big deficit, is it?
No, it's not ideal. It's like I said,
this
is a
triple header. Podium credits.
Yeah, like this is a triple header on the final round of the showdown, basically. So, yeah, if you're going to have a shortfall, you wouldn't want to choose Brands Hatch as the round to do it. Let's put it that way, because it's such a backbone part of the championship. Even the Indy layout, it's the backbone of the championship. You don't want to have a bad Brands Hatch bike around here if you can help it. And he tends to go a lot stronger on the Indy layout, but the Grand Prix layout is when the flaws of the Kawasaki get exposed a little bit. So it's not ideal, to say the least, that Haslam seems to have a problem around it. I mean, don't get me wrong, far from the end of the world, he finished in 3rd in both races. Like, that's not... it's not a crippler by any stretch. It's still a couple of podium credits. It's still a very strong weekend overall. He'll take it. I think it's the grand scheme of things here. I think it's the phrase I'd go with here. He still extended his championship lead in the regular season format. He's lost some podium credits to Brooks and to Irwin, which I don't think he's going to lose too much sleep over that. But it's something that's going to probably be a cloud in his mind, especially given how last year played out. I don't think he's going to want a bike that has problems around Brands Hatch, because it could come... chances are it will go down to at least the penultimate race in the championship, you'd think, given the podium press advantage. Haslam is obviously still going to be landslide favourite to win the championship, but you'd think, if you've got a shortfall on a triple header weekend, it does open the door for someone like Brooks to come in and sweep right at the end, and you don't really want that if you can help it, if Brooks is in contention.
No, for those that are wondering when we're going to discuss the big news that's surrounding Leon Haslam, we'll discuss that in the news segment in a little bit. But in terms of his season at the moment, he pointed out after last weekend that this has never been his best circuit. I mean, let's not forget that he had struggled on the Brands weekend last season, the end of last season, before that brake failure in the final race. He'd already lost a pretty sizable championship lead going into the first of those 3 races that weekend. Didn't he go into the race weekend with around 25 points, then had just 2 in his pocket going to that final race, that he'd already been uncompetitive in the first 2 races of that weekend? It is a shortfall they're going to have to work on. He did say that it's never been his best circuit. We didn't have the pace to win this weekend, so it's something we'll need to look at before the showdown, as it's no good coming into the final 3 races here knowing my rivals are stronger. He says, that being said, winning a title is about maximising your stronger circuits and damage limitation at your weaker ones. And I'd say 2 podiums is pretty good at a circuit where the Ducati and the Yamaha are clearly a bit stronger than us. Again, all of that is well and good, but when the points are near enough reset before the next visit to Brands, you can limit the damage as much as you want. The system's going to do damage itself by resetting the points to 500 when we get to the showdown. So, yeah, even at this stage, even with such a strong lead in the championship, Kawasaki and Leon Haslam are far from infallible at the moment. And they will want to iron out those kinks before we get to the showdown with Haslam, who's had 6 wins and 10 podium finishes from the 12 races we've had so far, which is a pretty decent strike rate. Power circuit still to come as well before we get to the showdown. Thruxton, which is next, which is, as you're listening to this, around a week away, or the first weekend of August, same weekend as Brno MotoGP. You know, that is the fastest circuit in the country. So if you're down on top end speed there, you're going to struggle. So yeah, Haslam will want to try and make some gains with his Kawasaki before they go there. Elsewhere then, the two race results looked very, very similar. And they were actually very, very similar races, even if you didn't watch them. The same top three, with the victories going to Brooks, seconds going to Irwin, thirds going to Haslam. Both fourth places went to Jake Dixon, who just simply didn't have the pace to go with the front two. Couldn't go with Haslam in race one. Was able to just about keep Haslam in sight in the second race, but was unable to beat him. And a decent enough weekend, I suppose, Dre, for Dixon in terms of his ultimate goal, which is to make the showdown. He's still second overall in the points. But it's almost like the Olympics, isn't it? Where if you're going to go well, there's no good finishing fourth because there's no medals for the guy that finishes fourth. And for Jake Dixon, as good as it is, and he's going to make the showdown anyway, no podium credits for finishing fourth. And that's really what he's after.
Yeah, that's going to be the problem. And it also earmarks a bigger problem for Dixon, is that he's behind Haslam on the same bike. Mm. That's the problem here, is that, you know, if Haslam's going to have problems, then there's a good chance some of those will be reciprocated in the Kawasaki, the RAF reserves Kawasaki that Dixon's on as well. He showed, like, again, he was further behind Haslam. That's the guy he wants to be beating week in, week out, if he wants to be thinking about winning the championship. And he was behind him in both races again. And it's something that he's going to have to work on and improve. I mean, yeah, it's a competitive enough series right now where he's going to be forgetting about Glenn Irwin and Josh Brooks and Bradley Ray, and maybe even to a sense people like Christian Iden, for example. But, like, if you're thinking championship, your main target is going to be the guy on the same bike as you. And at the moment, that is Haslam. And he needs to start beating Haslam to really start putting a dent in the podium credit advantage, and also just to win the championship in general.
Mm. Yeah, he's got work to do. As Dick said, I mean, he would still go into the showdown were it to start now second to Haslam. So he has racked up podium points, but yeah, the wins are still too infrequent. He's still yet to answer the biggest question, I suppose, which is, can he win somewhere other than Knockhill? He hasn't done that yet, but he does sit fourth overall, and he sits second overall. He was fourth in both races at Brands last weekend, and he is, as near as makes no difference, guaranteed to be in the showdown based on how many points it usually takes to get in. Jake Dixon on 162 is virtually certain already of making the showdown. Josh Brooks is fourth at the moment in the championship behind Glenn Irwin. But when we come to the man in fifth, we have an interesting conundrum, because this is Bradley Ray, who's now fifth in the championship on 115 points. Only took 3 points from Brands Hatch GP. He was 13th in the first race, and that was about as good as it was. That was where he was on pure pace. Didn't score any points in the second race, and that wasn't because of a DNF. That was because on pure pace, he could only manage 16th in the second race at Brands GP. He's only scored 14 points in the last 6 races, which is a major shortfall. Of course, hasn't been on the podium since race 1 at Brands Indy back on the 14th and 15th of April. And it has to be said, Dre, and we didn't think he would be saying this back at April, Bradley Ray, is he a genuine risk now of not even making the showdown altogether?
Well, let's be reasonable here. He has 115 points right now. The nearest non-showdown rival right now, because Buchan is also now in the top 6, given he had 2 places this weekend, he's pushed Shaky out of the zone, which now makes it a little bit easier to look at how the showdown's starting to form, because, again, Shaky is not scoring points again this season. The nearest threat is Christian Iden. Christian Iden is in 8th place. He's on 88 points. So that means he is 37 points behind. No, 27, which one should I say? Sorry. That's just a bit slow today. 27 points. So, like, Iden would have to start getting back to the... Iden would have to be something near his best, I think, where he's scoring the championships.
The gap was 45 going into Brands.
Good point. A 5th and a 6th for Iden this weekend is good,
like,
points.
A 5th and a 6th isn't... That's not a big result. But if Bradley Ray is going to continue to trade in DNFs and 13ths, he's not going to make it in.
Yeah. He's only scored points in 2 out of his last 6 races. It's not a good sign. It's signs that maybe, like, is something up with the build base team in general? Is something going on here? Is Bray been focusing on the A tower? Is that it?
I mean, to ask another question, Dre, I don't know whether you're about to ask it yourself, but I mean, I keep looking at Bradley Ray and I keep thinking to myself, I keep trying to remind myself the kid's 21. Did we simply expect too much too soon from him when he did that double at the start of the year?
Maybe we did. Maybe that's part of the problem. I'm not sure. It's the old paradox of, do you want to give too much endorsement to a young rider too soon? Because you know, it's very easy to get excited about young, especially when you open the season like he did with such a brilliant double win he had at Donington. And especially coming off the end of last season where he was challenging for victories then as well. It was hard not to be emotionally invested in this because, again, like I said, the guys rode really well for the for the end of last year in the showdown rounds and then the first round of this year. Has Suzuki been pegged back in terms of upgrades? Has the rest of the field caught up in terms of development?
I don't think it's a Suzuki problem. Cause just look how well Richard Cooper went on the other build-based bike at Brands GP.
Well.
I mean, he finished, what, seventh in the first race, and he was on the fringes of the podium battle when he went off in race two.
Yeah, maybe it's a Suzuki adjustment. Maybe because, again, the bikes at Suzuki are very different. And, again, more electronics and, you know, more resources thrown into Yeah, exactly. Bridgestone tires. It's more the World Superbike format than the BSB format, which run their own unique setup in terms of support and whatnot. So, yeah, it's finicky to say the least on this one. Maybe it's that. Maybe him having to adjust to different bikes. Maybe that's been part of the problem. Maybe his mind's been focused on this 8-hour race and maybe not on the task at hand. Again, maybe it's just the fact he's 21, you know, and that's something that it's easy to forget about him as a talent. I'm not sure what it is exactly, but it's not quite right here, and yeah, it's not been helpful to say the least. And yeah, like, all right, I wouldn't say he's at risk of losing his showdown spot just yet. We still have 7 races to go between now and the showdown wall closing. That's plenty of time for things to change. But as it stands right now, he's had a bad run of form and he needs to snap out of it quickly.
I mean, it's the Brands weekend that would worry me if I was a Bradley Ray fan. And he kind of hit touches on this himself after the weekend, speaking to Ollie Rushby of MCN, where he says he dispels the theory that Suzuka's having an issue or having an effect on him. He says, I've had enough time to come back and switch my brain off and get used to the Pirellis again. Which, I mean, just because he says that doesn't necessarily mean that it genuinely isn't affecting him, but he says so. He says it's not a problem. He says, to be honest, we've had this problem for a few rounds now, even before I went to Suzuka. It's just got worse here this weekend. While we've not been on the podium in the last 3 rounds, we have still been quick, but we can't even say that here. So we need to put our heads together and make a plan. And that's exactly the point I would make, is that at least when he wasn't scoring points at Snetterton, for instance, he was crashing from very, very strong positions. So the pace was clear there, and wasn't he on pole position at Snetterton as well? Bradley Ray. So the pace was clear there, and he was, you know, knocking on the door of the top 5 at Knockhill as well. I mean, he was 5th in race 1 and then crashed out of 5th in race 2. So the pace was clear there, but the pace wasn't even there at Brands Hatch GP. So Thruxton may well tell us a lot next weekend. Obviously that will put the other side of his exploits at Suzuka, and we'll get onto that in a moment with Bradley Ray involved in that race. Thruxton may tell us a lot, and as I mentioned, we need to remember that this kid is still 21 years old, and you know, 21 year olds, you know, we shouldn't expect him to be the finished article just yet in British Superbikes. So, I mean, the fact that he could potentially still win this championship this season is still an incredible story, and based on where he has been in his career and where he was even last year, for him to make the showdown full stop, if we'd have said at the start of the season, Bradley Ray makes the showdown, we'd say that's a terrific achievement. And obviously what he did at the very start of the season at Donington has kind of blurred the lines a little bit and maybe made us think that more was potentially on than it was. But we shall see on Bradley Ray. He is still fit at the moment and he is still in the showdown spot. As Dre mentioned a moment ago, the final spot at the moment is occupied by Danny Buchan, who's in 6th spot. He has 111 points. So in terms of the next fully fit rider behind him, he has 23 points in his pocket over Christian Iden. And when we look at what he did at Knockhill, Dre, where he got that double podium, sometimes when riders do that, when they have a breakthrough weekend, sometimes there's a drop-off straight afterwards. But we can't really say that Danny Buchan had that. He had 2 8th place finishes, and to me, he looks like he's doing exactly what Peter Hickman did last year. And stealthily, with regular point scores, he still scored in every single race this year. If he keeps that form up for the next seven races, I think Booker makes it in.
I think he will. He's going to make it very hard for Ridden to take major points out of an advantage. I think Buchan, all he realistically has to do here is just keep his head screwed on, don't make any silly mistakes, and just, you know, take the maximum that bike can give you at the moment and just find a way to do it. Because the way he's going right now, yeah, why not? Like, why not think showdown spot? He's got a good amount of points in hand on Ridden at the moment. And, yeah, like, why not? Why not think big? I mean, he's good enough. He's got more than enough ability. And if he can snap off a really good weekend like Hickman did last year, all of a sudden, I think his was at Cadwell. Like, if he can do that, he's definitely going to be in. So
he is. And yeah. I think when I look at the overall points, and obviously we look at the gap, and as we say at the moment, it's 23 between Buchan and Ridden. And we think of that as a race worth of points. But in terms of where these guys tend to finish through the course of a year, it's probably more than that. It's probably one and a half or two races. You know, when Christian Ridden himself, who's is a class rider, make no mistake about it, but his best finish so far this year is a fifth place, which he equaled at Branch DP. So when your best finish in a race all year is fifth and you're 23 points back, he's essentially two races behind Gary Buchan, because Christian Iden's not going to suddenly win some of the next, you know, five of the next seven races and just blast his way into the top six. So I still think if Buchan can continue to average at sort of an seventh or eighth place every race, which is near enough what he's doing this season, 111 points from 12 races, that's about 9 points around. If he continues to average at that, I think he's going to make it into the top six without any difficulty. It would take a freakishly good run from a Laverty, a Hickman, an O'Halloran to knock him out. So he's looking good at the moment. Is Danny Buchan. He is safe at the moment in that top six. We've touched a little bit on Ridden, Dre. Christian Ridden and Michael Laverty, who are running the Tyco BMs. They are both sort of on their best days, just about creeping to that top six. And both are having solid seasons. We mustn't forget once again that Christian Ridden, much like he does every season, tends to miss a round or two through injury along the way, which Ridden did earlier this season at Alton Park. So they're having decent enough seasons in eighth and ninth overall. But as I mentioned, neither of them seem to be on the verge of a run that's going to force them in, do they?
They don't, no. And, like, especially in the case of Laverty, who's had one podium for the year. Ridden has been here before. He's been in this sort of ballpark territory before, especially last season, where it looked like he had a showdown spot in hand, until we all know what happened at Silverstone Race 3. You know, the controversy regarding whether that race should have even happened in the first place, quite frankly. But Ridden's been here before, and I think Ridden is the more talented of the two BMW riders, and I think that, you know, he has more upside, and I think he's got a better chance of tangling for podiums. It's a bit more stacked at the top in BSB than I thought it was going to be this year, especially with Shaky not being around. It's still pretty loaded at the top, so it's going to be hard to score podiums right now, and I think there might be too many better riders in front of them to really do major damage to the championship as it stands. But if anyone can go on a run, I think it could be Christian Ridden, who's always been a consistent top six level rider when he's healthy, when the bike is working. So I would give Ridden an outside chance, but he's got a lot of work to do between now and the showdown rounds.
He has. I mean, as I mentioned, there's no one... As Dre mentioned, Iden's the likeliest bet to make a run at the showdown, but there is no one who seems to be particularly putting their hand up to make a run. Perhaps the riders we thought might be able to do that up until this weekend were the Honda riders of Dan Linfoot and Jason O'Halloran. O'Halloran had a disastrous weekend in terms of his points return of the weekend. He did finish both races, but 14th and 15th for him, so he only picked up 3 points from his two rounds. Whether he's still suffering from the injuries that he picked up at Imola in his World Superbike outing, we can only guess. Dan Linfoot, who, when he has been fully fit, has produced some great results. He had a fourth and a third at the opening round, then missed the next four races, came back and had a fourth in race two at Snetterton, then got injured again. At Brands Hatch GP, he got injured again, where he high-sided early out of race one, described it as the biggest crash of his career, fractured his left scaphoid. and looks like he's going to face another couple of weeks out, including missing the Suzuki Great Tire, which he was entered in this weekend. This certainly appears to be a team and a pair of riders, Dre, that are just having zero luck this season, and it looks like it's accounted for any hope of making the showdown for either of them.
It looks that way. It's been, this is almost a write-off year for Honda, purely through injury. They've been so unfortunate, you know, to have O'Halloran take a ding at a round that he wasn't even really supposed to be racing at. And then Linford, again, has had an awful crash at Clearways in race one. Again, did his foot in real bad, and again, has now missed the Suzuki 8 hours, one of the biggest races of his career to date.
Yeah, because whenever they've got two fully fit riders and two strong bikes out on the track, they've been quick.
Yeah, they've been right up there. Like, they've been, you know, both Linford and O'Halloran have challenged for wins this year, like they always seem to do. When the Honda is clicking, the Fireblade is working, they're challenging for wins. They are more than good enough to do that. We saw it from Linford, especially last season, where he seemed to really turn a corner in the showdown rounds last year. You know, won a couple of races last season and, you know, really worked very, very hard to turn himself into a true, like, elite BSB-level rider again. And this season, just through sheer bad luck, it's just not worked out for either of them this year, through injuries and just, you know, temperamental bike. And it's just not worked overall.
No, it hasn't. Unfortunate for them. They will no doubt still look to pick up the odd win as we go into the second half of the season, but a showdown spot now looks to be beyond them. Let's run you through the results then from last weekend. Bear with me, they may sound very, very similar. Race 1 went to Brooks from Glen Irwin by just 0.2 of a second. Haslam was 3rd, Dixon 4th, and Iden 5th. Pete Aikman 6th, ahead of Richard Cooper, Danny Buck, and Andy Irwin, and Michael Laverty in 10th. The rest of the points went out to Chrissy Rouse. Best result for him so far. Tommy Bridewell, who's back in BSB with the Motorpedo Ducati team, who replaced Taylor McKenzie with them. Bradray 13th, O'Halloran 14th, and Mason Law for the WD-40 team in 15th position. Race 2 went to Josh Brooks from Glen Irwin and Leon Haslam once again. Dixon 4th again. Taz McKenzie 5th, more on him in a second. Christian Iden 6th. Tommy Bridewell 7th. Danny Buck in 8th. James Ellison, who had mechanical problems on his Amblehire Tag Yamaha in 9th. Just seems whichever Yamaha team Ellison rides for, that bike goes pop. He was 9th. Peter Hickman, 10th on the BM, with Mike Laverty 11th. Andy Owen 12th. Luke Mossy, who was quick through practice and qualifying, but it kind of went wrong for him on race day, 13th. Having crashed in race 1. Chrissy Rouse 14th and Jason O'Halloran 15th, beating Bradley Ray to the final point. Before we come on to the championship standings, though, Dre, we should mention Taron McKenzie, really. Second of the McCams Yamahas. Mm. And his weekend was kind of a reflection of how much progress the team appears to be making. But this is a rider who, we shouldn't forget, is a British Superbike rookie at the moment. Yeah. Had a difficult 2017, of course. He was, you know, dominating the British Super Sport Championship once again. Then he took the very brave decision to try and fill Danny Kent's shoes at the Kiefer Moto 2 team, where he was really on a hiding to nothing. And he's been steadily learning through this British Superbike season. And when you look at his results, they've been steadily improving and improving and improving. Fifth at Brands in race 2 was his career best. And it's not going too far to say that before he lost control in race 1, he was knocking on the door of a rostrum.
That looked like a podium to me. That really did look like a podium for Taron McKenzie. It just fell away on the penultimate lap. His dad was in the back, and he was absolutely devastated. You could see just how close he was and just how unlucky that felt. As you say, it's more a reflection on the team because, you know, Taron is a rookie. He has struggled at times, like you expect all rookies to in this championship. It's hard to, you know, get your foot in the door. But he's had some good results. He's been hovering around the top 10 for most of the season. You know, had that sixth earlier in the year as well at Snetterton. So he's shown he's capable. The talent is more than there with this kid. This was the most consistent I think he's looked on a BSB bike all weekend. He qualified well. He raced well. The race pace was there. His race craft was solid. You know, he was not afraid to mix it up with championship leader Haslam and other riders like that on occasion. He was riding very, very well all weekend long. It's a real shame about the accident there that it doesn't really reflect how well he rode all season. So props to McCams for getting good results out of both their riders and just the improvement for Taron as the season's gone on.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to come too late for him to have any kind of hope of the showdown, McKenzie. He's on 47 points at the moment. So he trails the sixth rider in the top six, Danny Buchan, by 64 points, which with seven races to go, he's going to struggle to make up that many points in seven races. But he may well be an interesting sort of rear gunner for Brooks. He might be quite a joker card for the McCamus team to play later in the season if he continues to improve at this rate. So we'll follow his progress with interest. Championship standings then, here's how they look at the moment. Haslam leads it on 242 points from Jake Dixon on 162. So it's an 80-point lead for Haslam at the moment. Glenn Irwin trails Dixon by 17 in third. Josh Brooks is in fourth on 130 points. Brad Ray fifth on 115. And Danny Buchan sixth on 111. Outside the top six, Shaky Byrne is 7th on 98, Christian Iden is 8th on 88, ahead of Michael Laverty 9th on 78, and Peter Tipton 10th on 68. As far as the podium points are concerned, which affects the showdown, of course, when we get to September and the first round of the showdown at Alton Park, Leon Haslam has 38, so he would be 22 clear at the moment of Jake Dixon, who's next up on 16. Bradley Ray, if he makes it, would be third. He's on 13 podium points, 10 of which he got at the very first round. The other three he got at the third race of the year. We have Glenn Owen on 12, Brooks on 11, and Shaky Byrne, of course, on 9, but we won't see him for the rest of the year. Outside of that, in terms of podium points, we have Jason O'Halloran, who has 4, but he's unlikely to make the showdown. 6th at the moment, Danny Buchan, who's likely to make the showdown. He only has 2 podium points, so if he's to have any hope later in the year, he needs to add to that. And we have 3 other riders who have just 1 podium point based on their 1 step on the podium so far this season. They are James Ellison, or James Ellison counts himself among those. Michael Laverty's another, but they are unlikely to make the showdown themselves either. Dan Linfoot, of course, being the other one who got his podium at the very first weekend of the season. Next round of the British Superbike Championship comes, as you're listening to this, in around about a week's time. It is on the first weekend of August, and it is that the fastest circuit on the calendar. It is Thruxton. That comes on the 3rd, 4th and 5th of August. To the news, and there is not a lot of it, as you can imagine, because both MotoGP and World Superbikes are on their summer break. But we have some good news to bring you from British Superbikes, because I'm sure you're all aware of the situation surrounding Shaky Byrne. We discuss him a lot on this show, and it usually follows with the words, but he's injured and won't race for the rest of the season. Now, you all know the circumstances surrounding Shaky Byrne's injury, but Trey, we've had good news this week surrounding the greatest rider in the history of British Superbikes, because the halo that he's been wearing ever since that terrible near paralyzing accident that he suffered earlier in the season, it's finally been removed from Shaky's head. So one of the first big hurdle of Shaky's road to recovery has been overcome.
Yep, the halo has come off. Good to see. He talked about it on Instagram earlier this week, and you could tell it meant a lot to him to make it this far. In terms of his recovery, I mean, he also said we are still a long, long way away before we're able to have any sort of conversation about Shaky getting on a bike again and racing on it. But in terms of just a human being from a quality of life standpoint, it's great to see Shaky make progress. I mean, the big halo has come off. He's in another neck brace now for another 3 months. Until the end of August, and then we'll have to go from there and see how his neck is healing, and basically go from there. Basically, but he said even just to have a shower without the halo device on his head for the first time in several months was a luxury. So you could kind of tell just how far, or just how much this injury has ravaged his quality of life in the short term. So great to see that Shaky is on the mend slowly, and they've genuinely made some progress.
Yeah, I was going to make that very point in terms of his quality of life. I'll first of all read you the full Instagram post from Shaky Byrne, which was the first image we saw of him without the halo on his head, with simply the neck brace. He says, so there you have it, the halo is off. Far from the end of the road, though, it's the start of the next episode. The neck is literally just starting to show signs of bone growth. I'm going to be in this brace now until the end of August. Back for another scan, then hopefully start physio to try and get some movement. I'll have another CT scan at 6 months to see if there's any more progress. Bone growth-wise, then in 9 months, I should hopefully be able to have all the metal work removed from my spine. Long road ahead, but a nice step made today. I can't even begin to tell you how good the 20-odd minute shower I just had felt, which is great. And the outpouring, I mean, the first few comments you could see on the Instagram poster from Loris Baz and Jonathan Ray, both sending their support. And, you know, he is, as we've said before, such a popular rider, just not just in British superbikes, but just in motorsport, motorcycle racing. Everyone likes Shaky Byrne for good reason. He's one of the ultimate good guys in our sport. But as you say, just the pure quality of life. I mean, it's easy for us to just sit here and imagine, but just purely looking at him last weekend and looking at him whenever we've seen him on TV, Dre, and with that halo still on his head, and you know, still the fact that anytime he wants to sort of turn to speak to someone, he has to turn his whole body rather than being able to simply turn his head, which is something we just should be take for granted. And you know, as he says in that Instagram post, he's not going to be able. He's still going to have this neck brace on until the end of August, and then hopefully try to get some movement. So it's going to be at least another month or two before he could even encounter some movement. That's something we just take for granted, but just being able to turn your head without actually having to turn your entire body, just imagine how that must be just purely to live with, and how frustrating that must be to live with, and how just difficult that must be to try and get your head around, no pun intended, with Shaky Byrne. And what amazes me with this guy, and I know we only see him for the times we see him on TV, so I'm sure there have been some dark moments for him, but just how positive the guy still maintains. He still seems to have that sort of permanent smile on his face. I defy anyone to have gone through what he's gone through. And he explained in this Instagram post that he's still going to have metalwork in his spine for another 9 months. Yet the guy continues to still go through life with permanently just this amazing positivity, which I just wouldn't be able to have myself.
Yeah, if I couldn't turn my head for the best part of a year, I would have no idea how much that would mess me up. Like, you know, or like banging your head on a bus or something, or you know, just taking a shower, or even removing your clothes is going to be difficult. Like that, that's something that would drain me mentally. So for the fact that Shaky was out of major surgery and was cracking jokes within mere hours of being able to get his phone back, his positive mental attitude is inspiring and nothing short of a walking miracle, given how well he played. Given how he played, but also not only given how much of a stress and a burden it's been. He's incredible for that. And like every Instagram post I see him, he's smiling. Every interview he's taken when he's still come back for his punditry gigs on World Superbikes with Matt Roberts and Leon Haslam in the Eurosport booth, for when he's, I watched him this afternoon on ITV's highlights of the BSB round with Greg Haynes. And again, always smiling, always in positive spirits, joking about his situation, about how, you know, if I can't come back, I have to be stuck doing this then as a pundit instead. And, you know,
have you seen the one on his Instagram of as he captions it, full factory titanium and ceramic rods. the positivity, but again, just try and put this into your mind. That's the kind of metalwork that's in his body at the moment.
Try
and put him back together. And the other funny one, which was of a specially made chair for him, obviously given the way he obviously has to sit at the moment, they made a chair for him which has a piece of paper which reads "Shaky only" underlined. Shaky captions it, "Some full factory support from Eurosport for me here at Brad's." which again, just the positivity he's showing. And you know, his latest caption is that the halo's removed, and he has the caption where he says, "That uncomfortable moment, lol, you're making my armpits sweat." which is brilliant. I mean, as Dre says, what an inspiration the guy is. Just how he's dealing with this whole thing is just inspiring. And it almost just pales into insignificance, the question of, is he going to race again? Because that near enough doesn't matter at the moment. Just can he regain that quality of life that he's been searching for at the moment would be good enough. But the way he's handling the whole thing is incredible. And, you know, we take our hats off to Shaky Byrne, and we continue to wish him all the very best as his recovery
absolutely
steps up a notch. And, yeah, he can then regain that quality of life. And hopefully, come the end of August, he may well have to have the neck brace removed as well. We shall see. Of course, we'll update you on his progress as it goes along. But yeah, follow him on Instagram for all the updates on that. He is a great follow. 67shaky is his Instagram username.
67shaky, yep.
He is an inspiring human being to be going through all of this at the age of 41. It's incredible. The biggest news, really, that's broken this week, and really the only news that's broken this week, it was a big one. It again surrounds a British Superbike hero in Leon Haslam, who, of course, encountered his own injury nightmare at the end of last year when he lost the title to Shaky Byrne at Brands. If he loses the title at the end of this year, he won't have a chance to go for it again next year, but he's got a very good excuse for that because he's going to be competing for the World Championship instead. He has signed for the KRT Kawasaki official team in World Superbike, so he will be replacing Tom Sykes at the factory Kawasaki team alongside Jonathan Rea. And first of all, Dre, before we say anything else, what a great story this is for Leon Haslam, who, when he left the World Superbike Championship, when he left the then Honda team to go to the British Superbike Championship, sorry, he left the Red Devils, Roma, a prettier team, didn't he, to go to British Superbike. So we kind of thought that this was Leon Haslam winding down and hopefully he could win a British Superbike Championship before he goes. But he's forced his way back into the premier team in World Superbike Championships, which says a lot for Leon Haslam and the quality of a rider he is.
Yeah, like, Leon Haslam is world-class. He has been world-class for a long, long time. And this is a guy that's kind of been overlooked in many a series for other, maybe more exciting, you know, more younger talents. And, you know, it's understandable. That's the way bike racing is. It's shifted in the last 5-6 years, you know, towards more of the, you know, the younger, extremely talented junior-class rider and whatnot. I get that. I totally understand that. But Haslam is a world-class rider, and he was winning races on that Aprilia, something that Aprilia now at Milwaukee would be dying for in World Superbikes, to have them challenge for wins like that. Haslam is world-class. He's a consummate professional. He's an excellent rider. He's a real, truly grafty sort of rider as well. We saw at the Suzuka last year just how hard he was willing to try to win that race, effectively on his own, trying to win the Suzuka 8 Hours. And, you know, of course, this season in BSB, it probably wouldn't
play out. There's no question that effort for Kawasaki has played a part in this decision.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Him and he combined with his BSB form at the moment, which is, again, the best run of his career so far, without a question. It's one of those things where that had to be nothing short of impressive. He's been brilliant the last year in bike racing now, and you know he's been gifted a chance of a lifetime now to join the KRT racing team. You know, the excellent Kawasaki team. You know, the team that has Jonathan Rea on it. You know, probably will be 4-time world champion by the time we get to 2019. And what a golden chance he now has to win a championship at the World Superbike level alongside Jonathan. And it's a wonderful opportunity for a real grafter, a real hard worker, and a real tough rider's rider in Haslam. So I'm delighted that he's been given this opportunity. It may not be the sexiest pick in the world, but you've got a good chance of having the reigning world and domestic British Superbike champions on your team for next year. That's something you can't pass up. It's a fantastic opportunity, and yeah, it's a wonderful looking team when you look at it. My God, Jonathan Rea and Leon Haslam together.
Henry Chapman points out in the chat, being from Ealing doesn't hurt. I'm referring to Leon Haslam.
West London guys are tough.
and Haslam, who's just to pick up on what Dre mentioned, with him perhaps not being the sexy pick, he's 35, Leon Haslam, at the moment. So it's very rare that you force your way back into the World Superbike paddock at that age, unless you're perhaps coming down from MotoGP, for instance. It's a measure of what Leon Haslam's been doing in British Superbikes and just in general for Kawasaki earn this ride. Without sounding disrespectful to Leon Haslam, whether you could argue, we could argue until the cows come home, whether he's as good a rider pound for pound as Tom Sykes, as much a reason for Leon Haslam getting this ride, Dre, with all due respect, the fact that it's his personality that's earned him this ride, and the fact that he's going to slot in seamlessly alongside Jonathan Rea and not rock the boat too much.
Yeah, probably. I mean, ultimately you are a team at the end of the day, and it's not going to be a fun experience coming to work every day when one rider isn't in the current outfit. I mean, say what you will about Tom Sykes, but he didn't exactly help his case when he had that scathing Eurosport interview. No. He probably burned any bridge he had left with Kawasaki at that point. And you know what? Maybe he was frustrated, and I understand why he did it, but you know, your team is going to get rid of you for that when, one, your performances aren't good enough, and two, you're coming out and basically criticizing the team openly so the world can hear it, and your team wasn't even clued in that you were going to do that. Like Sykes pretty much sealed his own fate within his own team by doing that in the first place, for better or worse. So, yeah, absolutely, from a team dynamic standpoint, why not get Haslam, who is, again, is a real pros pro, has never really stepped out of line. He's not afraid to speak his mind, but at the same time, he doesn't rock the boat, and that is a big part of it with, you know, with Haslam as a rider and as a human being. He's not that sort of guy. He's not outspoken like that. He's not going to go out of his way to upset people. So, yeah, it helps. It certainly helps personality-wise when you're going to have a guy that's going to come in and just stay the ship a little bit. I don't have Jonathan Rea as the sort of guy that's going to, you know, upset the apple cart. And even if he did, who cares when he's winning that much? So, for me, yeah, they get along very well. They're good mates. And I'm sure, you know, I don't see any reason why they wouldn't be able to get along.
No, absolutely not. They'll get on just fine. In World Superbikes, but again, I don't want to make this sound like I'm trying to take anything away from Leon Haslam's big opportunity with Kawasaki, but one of the questions that initially came up, and it came up in our very own Discord server, was, is Leon Haslam essentially going to be a stopgap until Toprak Razgatlioglu is ready for the factory Kawasaki team? And again, Dre, with all due respect to Leon Haslam, is that kind of what he is?
Well, he's 35. I mean, how long do you expect him to stay at this ultimate level? I mean,
if he's winning next year, he's going to be a very hard rider to drop.
Exactly. That's going to be the problem. It's like Haslam's betting against himself. I don't know whether it's a 1 or a 2 year deal. I know Haslam was pushing for 2 years for obvious reasons. I mean, you know, if you can get a 2 year deal in that team at that age, then by all means do it. But most racing teams go into what I like to call the bet against yourself mode, like we've seen in F1 in the past with guys like Kimi Raikkonen or Valtteri Bottas, who they get these 1+1 deals where it's like you get a year, and if the team likes you, they'll give you another year. It's the rolling 1 year contract. Mark Webber had that too, and he was at Red Bull Racing. Same deal. It makes your team easier to manage, and you're basically encouraging your rider to bet against himself that he's going to be good enough to keep getting these opportunities. Again, no guarantees on that. But yeah, I don't blame Kawasaki for doing that, because ultimately he's 35 years old and there's no guarantee Haslam can keep going at this sort of level forever. And they have an extremely talented 21-year-old Turkish rider for the Pachetti team waiting in the wings, ready to go. If you're Kawasaki, you're golden right now. Like, you've got this all figured out. You've got the 5-year plan ready to go. Don't get me wrong. Like, I don't think there's a hurry to put Toprak in that seat. No. I mean, I think Toprak is a very good talent, but I think he's still got a bit more development to go through as a rider before I would say he's confident of being ready for, you know, the KRT team seat properly. But in the meantime, having a quality rider like Haslam, who's got experience in this series before, as a race winner in World Superbikes before, can't hurt.
No, absolutely. And congratulations to Leon Haslam. We wish him all the very best of luck.
Yes, absolutely.
With Kawasaki next season.
A real good guy.
A real good guy, one of the good guys. And yeah, I think it would be great for the sport as well. Not just for the sport, but for British motorcycle sport. If he can go there as the British champion, it would be a great story as well for Kawasaki Racing Team next year to have the reigning world champion and the reigning British Superbike champion in the same team would be a fantastic story. As far as Ducati are concerned, their second seat is still yet to be filled. Well, actually, both seats technically haven't been filled yet, because Chaz Davies hasn't put pen to paper yet, but we're expecting him to do so. I do wonder how happy Dorna will be if the four riders on the four premier bikes next season, potentially, with all due respect to Yamaha, are going to be four British riders, essentially, if Eugene Laverty gets the second Ducati seat. Just what Dorna want. But we shall see. We shall see, because we'll update you about that. As it goes. Speaking of Ducati, they had their own, essentially their own kind of fun fair last weekend at Misano, as the Ducati Day of Champions took place. The Race of Champions took place on the Sunday. It's the one other race that we can actually bring you a result off from last weekend. That and the British Speedway GP, which Bex is slowly trying to recover from. We'll tell you about that in a second. But the Ducati Race of Champions, here's how it finished. They all raced on identical V4 Panigales. Of course, all painted up in their different paint jobs based on based on which championship they were racing in. So, of course, the Aruba Ducatis had their Aruba liveries. The Fent MotoGP Ducatis had their MotoGP liveries. The Pramac GP liveries. The Avinti liveries, and so on. We'll give you the result in reverse order. Troy Bayliss, understandably, I suppose, given that he's 49, was 12th in this race. All 12 of these bikes, by the way, are on eBay until 5 p.m. on Saturday. So by the time you hear this, they might have closed. Wow. But you can't actually bid for these bikes. I'd love to see. Well, actually, we'll try and find this, how much they're going for at the moment as we record this. But yeah, Troy Bayliss, 12th on his Panigale. 11th was Carol Abraham, who was on the Nieto, of course, the Angel Nieto Aspar MotoGP bike. 10th was Jorge Lorenzo on his Ducati, obviously his Ducati Factory MotoGP liveried bike. 9th, just ahead of him, was Danilo Petrucci. 8th, Xavier Simeon, who was, of course, is the least heralded, perhaps, of the Ducati MotoGP riders at the moment. 7th, Andrea Dovizioso. 6th, Michael Rubin Rinaldi, who of course is the European-based World Superbike rider for the Aruba team. 5th, Marco Melandri, who of course has won at Misano in World Superbikes just last year. 4th, just ahead of him, was Jack Miller, of course the Pramac MotoGP rider. 3rd, Xavi Forres for the Barney team. 2nd, Tito Rabat, who of course is the Avinti team. And the winner... And we're happy for this, even though it's not a competitive victory. But given the season he's had, and given the last time we saw him on a factory Ducati, he was being catapulted through the air at 220 miles an hour at Mugello. The race winner, Dre, our favourite policeman, Michele Pirro.
Whoop, whoop, it's the sound of the police. I'm here for all of this. Yes, Michele Pirro, our favourite policeman. What a boy. That I did for him. That's awesome. That's a lot of really, really good riders in there. And Michele Pirro.
All on identical V4 Panigale Ducatis.
Like, someone give this man a job, please, okay? Like, he's really good at bike racing, okay? Like, really good. And he wants to race. So somebody let him race. I love Michele Pirro. Give that man a chance already.
Yeah, give that guy a ride. I'm a full-time ride. Yeah, we're trying to find it on eBay. We're going to try and find some of these Ducatis, given that we're not
talking about
this show. They may be on the Italian eBay site, but we'll try and find that out for you before we go on this show. Because last time I checked, Troy Bayliss's Ducati was the one that was going for the least amount of money, but it was still up in five figures, as you can imagine. And it's probably
like the mod people pay more money for Troy Bayliss's bike.
Yeah, the guy is a motorcycle racing legend and a Ducati legend, of course, at that.
I demand people open their wallets for Troy Bayliss. What's wrong with you people?
Yeah, the guy is an absolute hero.
All of you.
We'll just as we're talking, I'll just Google it on the Italian eBay. Yeah, no luck. We'll try and find this before we go, before the end of the show. But yeah, those bikes are going for quite a lot of money. At the moment. Speaking of superbikes worth a lot of money, let's look ahead to this weekend and the biggest motorcycle race on the planet. And before we go any further, Dre, are we going overboard by calling it that? I mean, MotoGP has got a lot of incredibly prestigious races, but you wouldn't say any of those races are particularly on the level of a Monaco or a Le Mans or an Indianapolis. That you can't really argue that there is one of those in MotoGP. So the closest that motorcycle racing, I suppose, has to a Monaco, an Indy 500, a Le Mans in 24 hours, probably is the Suzuka 8-hour.
Yeah, it probably is, especially given that now these factories really, really, really want to win this one. So much so that the actual World Endurance Championship that these guys are racing in almost takes a back seat. In fact, it pretty much does take a back seat to this, this headline event at Suzuka. The way I see it, this is one of the headline races of the year, and quite rightly so. I said it before, for some time, this is basically the all-star game for bikes, and that's what it feels like when you've got MotoGP, BSB, World Superbikes all being represented on several levels. So it looks fantastic. So I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, it's going to be a terrific race. Quickly, I'll give you, just coming back to what we were talking about a moment ago, I'll quickly give you an update from the last time this was covered in the news on these Ducatis. Troy Bayliss's bike, since we found out earlier the week, it's actually attracting the maximum number of bids so far.
Bayliss's
bike, so it has actually become the most bidded for bike. €120,000 it was going for last time it was updated. This is basically, by the way, just to give you the full details of this, all these 12 bikes that were raced on the Sunday in this Race of Champions are up for sale, with the Akrapovic pipes, the race bodywork, and the colours of each rider, as well as the rider's race settings that they ran on that bike. Basically, it, it is exactly as it raced that you can bid for these bikes.
It's identical. Wow.
Yep, so Bayliss's was going at €120,000 at last check. Bids for the bike used by Andrea Dovizioso stopped at €45,100. Jorge Lorenzo's went at €41,500. And of course, these bikes are still up for auction until Saturday, July 28th, so it's quite likely that the prices are going to go up even further. But that's a little bit of an update on to what they were going
for. Troy's going for €120,000 now.
Yeah.
You put the signal out there and people start bidding. I'm taking full credit for this one.
Yeah. Unfortunately, our Patreon backing doesn't quite allow us to purchase... He doesn't even allow us to purchase Xavier Simeon's Ducati just yet.
God damn it!
So maybe next year.
Twitter, I want to buy Xavier Simeon's V4 pad of garlic.
Yeah.
Let's make this happen, people. Yeah. We'll put it in the back garden.
Well, Xavier Simeon did run number 10, so we could just sticker another 1 on the end of it and have it 101.
Yeah, sorted.
Yeah, but back to Suzuka then, which actually doesn't feature any Ducatis, remarkably. It's a race, obviously, that's particularly focused on by the Japanese manufacturers who take this race phenomenally seriously, Dre. I mean, we just need to look at recent years and the way that Yamaha have taken this seriously. I mean, we've seen Yamaha employ MotoGP riders like Bradley Smith and Pol Espargaró when they won it for the first time 3 years ago. We've seen Honda roll out the likes of Casey Stoner, no less, to take part in this race. Of course, it does take place within the confines of a world championship, and we'll talk about that briefly in a bit, because unfortunately the Endurance World Championship, of which this is the finale, kind of takes a back seat to the overall race itself. But we cannot stress strongly enough how seriously the Japanese factories like Yamaha, Honda, Suzuki, etc., and Kawasaki, of course, how seriously they take this.
Absolutely. They really do want to win this one. I mean, and it's been an upturn in the last few years when Honda's dropping in dudes like Casey Stoner, and as the last few years have gone, and we've seen a real resurgence of just factories sending like their A game riders down there, trying to sort this out. Like, again, we've seen Honda send Casey Stoner in the past, and now they're sending Taka Nakagami. They had Leon Kamiya down here for this, replaced by PJ Jacobson. Yamaha, for the last 3 or 4 years, have sent at least, their World Superbike guys down there, Alex Lowe's and Michael Vandermark, the reigning champions this year, as well as in the past, their full-on MotoGP satellite team. That was Pol Espargaró and Bradley Smith had gone down there and taken part. Cal Crutchlow showing interest in it. Taka Nakagami is here this year. Even Suzuki are now sending guys like Sylvain Gintoli, who is a real loyal stallion of the factory, as a test rider for them at this point. As well as Bradley Ray, who's one of the young upstarts of their factory projects as well. So it's in the last 4 or 5 years, it's exploded in terms of popularity again, and just seeing riders, not only like the very, very best of the best, have even shown. I remember Valentino Rossi talking about it last year, saying if the dates matched up, he wouldn't mind having a go. It's shot back up in popularity again the last 4 or 5 years, and it's wonderful to see all these guys that are making the effort to come down and give it a crack and turn this into, again, like I said, I think I've put it before, it's very American sports. It's very much like an all-star game where you're seeing some of the very best from all three major, world and domestic biking series come down, have a go and race against each other in scenarios you wouldn't normally see in any other form of motorsport series. And I think it's wonderful. I think it's fantastic.
It is wonderful. And we're going to go into some of the key teams to look out for right about now as we look ahead to this race. there are a number of factories represented, but it's likely when we look at the entry list that the winner is going to come from one of four factories, all of which are Japanese. There are other factories taking part, like BMW have bikes out in this race as well. There is a Ducati Panigale, a 2016 spec Ducati Panigale for the Banner Racing Team, the number 82, running three Japanese riders, but they are unlikely to figure towards the front. A lot of these teams with Japanese backing are running full factory 2018 kit. So they are going to be up towards the front. And we'll start with Suzuki team. The likeliest Suzuki running up the front is going to be the Yoshimura Suzuki Racing Team, who finished very close to the front in recent years. Alex Lowe's helped them to a podium back in 2015 as well, the year that the 21 Yamaha took its first win. And when we go through their team, Dre, Takuya Tsuda, who is a trusted Suzuki test rider, makes up one third of their team. But the great interest for us comes in their other two riders. Bradley Ray, who we've covered earlier on in this show, has worked wonders. He's won races for them in the British Championship earlier in the season. And Sylvain Gintoli, a world champion in his own right back in 2014. Yoshimura Suzuki, they have knocked on the door in recent years of winning this race, but the Yamaha has just proved too strong for them. But they've certainly got a strong rider lineup this time. When Sylvain Gintoli is their lead rider, a world champion, we know they're taking this seriously.
Absolutely. They again, this is almost as big a lineup as Suzuki could possibly roll out. The only way it would be bigger is if they were rolling out any of their MotoGP.
Yeah, it rins.
And Ian Oni's probably too busy modelling for that anyway.
Yeah.
But the way it's going right now, that's about as stacked a team as you could possibly get for Suzuki, given the resources available to them. Gintoli, as mentioned, a former world champion with the Honda team, but also a guy that's been a very loyal test rider for some time. He's done wildcard appearances in MotoGP this season, as recently as Catalunya. He was a wildcard out there for the Suzuki factory. I know they struggled a little bit, but they were still out there riding. And, Bradley Ray has turned into a real, top tier level prospect in the British domestic series. And, he was really up there towards the end of last season. Ginter's even won a BSB race at Assen last year, which I'm still very happy about. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic team. I'm probably going to be saying that a lot in the next 20 minutes, so bear with me on this. But yeah, they've knocked on the door on several occasions again. I think they've probably got a taste for that now, with coming so close, and now they're going to bring down an uber talented team of Ray and Ginters, who's again a very solid all round rider. So, yeah, a lot to be excited about, and a team that again very much will be a top contender for the win, you'd think.
Absolutely, they ran strongly last year as well. Did the Suzuki team, the Yoshimura team? They were up on the in the podium battle last year as well. In terms of the Honda output, and it's amazing that we're talking about Honda this early, third, second of the four key factories, but they probably are third favourites at best, I suppose, this year, Dre. I mean, when we look at the teams they've got, there are two full factory Honda efforts in this race this year. There is Team HRC, which is running with some Red Bull backing, the number 33. Their team initially was Takumi Takahashi, Takaki Nakagami, MotoGP rider, of course, the only MotoGP rider in this race, the only MotoGP race rider in this race, and Leon Kamiya, of course, their lead World Superbike rider. Now, he, of course, injured himself in testing for this race and has been replaced by another World Superbike Honda rider in PJ Jacobson. And when we look at the 634 team, the Musashi Heart Pro team, HARC, which is Honda Active Riders Club, if you're wondering what the HARC stands for. They've got Ryo Mizuno, who's a test rider for Honda, Dominique Agata, of course, of Moto2, and Randy Depunier, former Grand Prix rider and World Superbike rider, who's been quite a regular in endurance racing since he left World Superbikes. Both strong teams, and it's Honda around a circuit that Honda own, for goodness sake, so you can't rule them out. But with all due respect to them, their teams probably lack the ultimate star power of their key rivals.
They probably do. I mean, I'm not sure what Taka's going to bring to the table, and it's not got the firepower that other factories do in the field, either factory team for Honda. And again, the fact they've got two efforts might actually be more counter. And he's actually probably a little bit better in this format compared to Moto2, where it's so competitive, it can sometimes make you look a little bit worse than you actually are. So for me, where I'm sitting, I think Honda have got good teams, and, you know, again, home field advantage is certainly going to help, given they own the track and all that. But I think it just lacks that ultimate star gunner at the front that's going to, you know, really pump in the really good lap times if he gets it going. So yeah, for me, where I'm sitting right now, I don't think Honda's quite got the legs for it. But again, I'm eager to see them try.
Yeah, in testing or in practice that took place today, as we record this, recording this on Thursday, the 26th of July, the 634 was third quickest in the assistance of Depunier. You'll probably be able to guess which two bikes are ahead of them, the two we're about to talk about. And the number 33, the Red Bull HRC Honda entry, with Jacobson on board, was 10th quickest. And top 10, by the way, do go into a one lap shootout for pole position on Saturday evening in Japan. Yay. Which we'll be keeping a close eye on. So the Hondas do look as if they are trailing a little bit at the moment. There are a number of other Honda-backed entries. We'll pick out some of the key ones for you in a little bit. But onto the two bike stray that I think we're probably expecting to dispute the win between them this weekend. And Kawasaki have only won this race once in its entire history. Only one Suzuka 8-hour win for Kawasaki, which gives you an insight into just how badly they'll probably want to win this year. And if it wasn't clear already just how much the Kawasaki team or the Kawasaki factory wanted to win this race, the fact that they've called upon the greatest rider in superbike history to try and win it for them kind of makes it clear, doesn't it? I mean, when you go back through history, 1993 was the one time Kawasaki won the Suzuka 8-hour, and on that occasion they had two World Superbike greats on board for them in Scott Russell and Aaron Slight. This year, Jonathan Rea has been rolled out.
They've pushed the emergency, in case of emergency, break glass, Rea-shaped button in the back office of Kawasaki. Jesus. Like, they came close last year, and Leon Haslam had a superhuman effort to even bring him into contention, having to race for over 5 of the 8 hours last year, if I remember correctly. And now they've called upon, as mentioned, probably the greatest superbike rider in history in Jonathan Rea. What a team that is. My God, if Rea could get to grips with Suzuka quickly, that's got more firepower than any team in the field. We know Haslam, as a proven commodity, is outstanding around here, and you know he will put in superhuman shifts to try and win it. I have no doubt about that. If Jonathan Rea can get to Gibson Suzuka quick, look out. They're the favourites for me. And again, they've been very fast in testing as well and in practice. The Kawasaki's look like the team to beat at the moment, and it's hardly surprising given they have Haslam and Rea in tow.
Yeah, Leon Haslam, as Dre mentioned, we understandably focus on Rea when talking about the Team Green Kawasaki, as it's called for this year. This is a great hour. But his teammates are Leon Haslam, who is a world-class rider, as we've already discussed, in terms of his move to World Superbikes for next year. And Kazumi Watanabe is the third rider for Team Green, who knows his way around Suzuka and has ridden for Team Green in the 8-hour in previous years as well. You know, he's essentially designated as their lead rider essentially for this race, with Haslam and Rea as his teammates, given that Watanabe knows this race and knows this circuit like the back of his hand. So yeah, what a formidable team they have for the 8-hour this season. And in practice on Thursday, Team Green were fastest, with Watanabe setting their fastest time at 2:07.2, half second clear of the bike we're about to discuss, the bike that's won this race for the last 3 years. I mean, we'll get on to predictions in a minute, Dre. You've kind of already answered this question, but I'll ask it anyway. Yamaha on that number 21 have won this race for the last 3 years and have kept the team that's won the last two of them intact for this year. And in many people's eyes, we'll start this race as favourites. But does the fact that Jonathan Rea is involved for Kawasaki tilt the balance their way?
I've learned to stop underestimating what Jonathan Ray can do on a motorcycle. I've stopped doing that for the last couple of years now. It served me well in terms of predictions. but that 21 crew is formidable. And like, they have a proven track record. They have a ton of experience now. They've been here before. They are capable of winning. Of course they are. And they know exactly how to win. And the Yamaha have done that very, very well in the last few years. And the R1 is a hell of a motorcycle. I've said this for quite some time. It's an incredibly versatile, easy to ride machine. And I know guys like Bradley Smith, who's raced down there in the past, has commented about how user friendly the R1 is and how comfortable it can be to ride around. So I could easily see how, you know, if somebody said to me, I think Yamaha's going to win again, wouldn't argue with it. But that Kawasaki team is riding so well, it's hard not to, you know, make them favorites right now. But the 21 crew, you know, they've won the last three of these for good reason. It's an incredible team, and they're going to take some beating.
They are. It's going to be fascinating to watch. The 21 Yamaha, just to confirm, is Katsuyuki Nakasuga, who has won or has been a third of the winning team in each of the last 3 years. Of course, he's the ever-present for the factory Yamaha team on that 21 bike. In the 8 hour from all of its visits since they returned to this race with the aim of winning it 3 years ago. And his teammates, Michael van der Mark and Alex Lowes, the two riders who have both won World Superbike races this year, earlier this year, breaking their ducks, and have both signed up to stay with the Yamaha Factory World Superbike team into 2019. And I guess what we can say about this team, Dre, which we can't really say about any of the other teams we've discussed, because all of them are slightly different from previous years, is that they all know what the 8 hour is all about. Van der Mark had won it before even, you know, he'd won it twice before he even joined Yamaha. He's a three-time winner, Michael van der Mark. Yeah. Twice with Honda, once with Yamaha. But this team is now racing together, the three of them, for the second year in a row. And as Leon Haslam showed last season, in an 8 hour race, sometimes you have to do things that you weren't expected to do. You know, sometimes strategies change. 8 hours is a lot of time for things to go wrong in a race.
Absolutely.
But when we look at this 21 Yamaha, and it's each of its last 3 years where it's won this race, I can't pinpoint a single moment across that 24 hours of racing in 3 years that anything has gone wrong with that 21.
Yeah, it's a technically flawless bike in that sense, right? And that's half the, like, that's 90% of the battle. If you can keep your nose clean and not have any problems, you are going to have a very good chance of winning that race right off the get-go, regardless of how fast you are. You know, if you're reliable, that's it's an endurance race at the end of the day. That's the whole idea. So, you know, if you could run the 8 hours without a technical problem, you're going to be in contention, because bigger teams, faster teams will take chances. They'll gamble. Guys are going to crash. It's an 8 hour race. You know, it goes from light to dark in Japan very quickly. It's Suzuka's a very dangerous technical circuit in that sense. So, yeah, there's a lot that could go wrong here. And, you know, it's one of those things where if you could just keep it clean for 8 hours, you'll be able to have a chance for sure. So, yeah, why not? Like, again, the way that they've been, Yamaha, the 21 crew especially, with practically no technical hiccups for 3 years, no wonder they've won, because that's such an important part of the race.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm going to pick 21 this year. I just think their experience will see them through. I mean,
more than fair enough.
The Team Green lineup is not exactly inexperienced, and it's a point worth making. We haven't made it yet. Jonathan Ray himself has won the Suzuka 8 Hour before. Because he had been a trusted, loyal servant to Honda for so many years. And he did race with the FCC TSR Honda team in 2012 alongside Tadio Cardo and Kazuki Akiyoshi. And he was part of this trio that won the race that year. So Jonathan Ray has won an 8 hour himself, as has Leon Haslam, also during his time with Honda. But Kawasaki have only won it once. And as I mentioned, that was all the way back in 1993. With Scott Russell and Alan Slide. But when I give you some of the names that won this race, it just gives you an idea of the prestige of this race and just how serious it is. Because this race has been going on for a number of years, all the way back to 1978. 27 of the, 27 of the 40 races have been won by Honda. And that includes their victory back in 1985, which included Wayne Gardner on board. He then won it again in 1986. for Team HRC. Eddie Lawson was part of the winning team for Yamaha in 1990. Wayne Gardner and Mick Doohan were the dream team for Honda in 91 that won the race. As I mentioned, Scott Russell and Alan Slight for Kawasaki in 1993. In 2001, Team Cabin Honda won it with two blokes called Edwards and Rossi as their riders. Wonder what they went on to achieve. Valentino and Colin Edwards as their two riders in 2001 when they won the race. DeGiro Kato, the late DeGiro Kato, he won the race in 2002 with Edwards for Honda as well. Kianari, we'll mention him in a second. He's racing this year. He won it with Toru Okawa in 2005. Yuichi Kianari also won it with Carlos Checa in 2008 for Honda. Last Suzuki win came in 2009. It was the Yoshimura team with Nobby Aoki as one of their three riders. In 2010, Takaki Nakagami was part of the winning trio alongside Kianari and Takumi Takahashi. Jonathan Ray won it in 2012 as part of the TSR Honda team. The Musashi Heart Pro team has won it in 2013 and its last win in 2014 when their riders were Takumi Takahashi, Michael Vandermark and Leon Haslam. And as I mentioned, Yamaha's 21, their Yamaha Factory Racing Team R1 has won it in each of the last 3 years. In 2015, Nakasuga was joined by Bradley Smith and Paul Espargaro. Espargaro stayed on for 2016 and was joined by Alex Lowes. And last year they won it with Nakasuga, Lowes and Michael Vandermark. That reads like a who's who of great motorcycle racers that have won this race. Who will add their name to it this year? There are plenty of other teams in the field for the Suzuka Rightower this year. It is such a huge event in motorcycle racing. All told, 64 teams were entered as of the 21st of July earlier this week when the provisional entry list for the week was published. 53 of them as EWC, as in the Endurance World Championship official entries, and then 11 registered as SST, which I'm going to make a slight guess stands for something along the lines of Suzuka Special Teams, based on which teams these are. For instance, the 21 Yamaha is among those. There are a number of teams that are entered at this event only. But when I take you to some of the other teams, for instance, some of the teams that you have to keep an eye on, we've mentioned the Honda teams. Team Kageyama, who often race at this event, they're another regular Suzuka 8-hour team. Yukio Kageyama, predictably, is one of their riders. Naomichi Uramoto is another of them. And keeping up the Grand Prix influence in this race, Moto2's Joe Roberts completes their lineup on the number 71 for Team Kageyama. Elsewhere, further down the field, we have British Superbike influence with the 135, the BMW Financial Services 135 team. Shinya Takeshi is their Japanese rider. He is partnered by the Taiko BMW duo of Michael Laverty and Christian Iden on their bikes. We have Carol Haneker, once of Moto3 and World Superbikes earlier this year. He's racing for the Mercury Racing team on the 121 alongside current BSB rider Sylvain Barrier and current World Superbike rider Andre Jezek. Current World Superbike rider Yoni Hernandez is racing for the Honda Endurance Racing team. That's a regular Endurance World Championship team. Their other riders are Sebastian Gimbert and Erwan Nigon of France. So many other teams to mention. Tommy Bridewell is in action this year for the S-Pulse Dream Racing team. He's going to be on the number 95. So keep an eye out for him. So many other teams worth keeping an eye out. Peter Hickman for Team NRT 48, another BSB rider in action alongside Kenny Foray and Julian Da Costa. But there are also, this year, the current regular Endurance World Championship runners, because this is the final round of the Endurance World Championship with, of course, the title Peter decided. Last year it was won by the Yamaha GMT 9040. They are in the running to win it again this season. And with the points system, as it works out for Suzuka Rightower, with 38 points handed out for the winners, technically we do have three teams still in the running to win this championship. With the FCC TSR Honda team leading on 146 points, ahead of GMT 94 Yamaha 136, and the Honda Endurance Racing team on 109. So they are only just in contention, but they need to win the race. Unlikely they're going to do so, but let's run you through their lineups for this this week's event. FCC TSR Honda, they are a Japanese backed team, but surprisingly they don't have any Japanese riders in their lineup. They have Josh Hook, who's an Australian who has raced at the 8 hours before. And two Frenchmen alongside him, Alain Tesche, former Moto3 rider, and Freddy Fauré, who is another experienced rider in the field. Yamaha GMT 94, who of course are trying to retain their title. They have pretty much the same lineup that won it for them last year. Mike Domeglio, former 125 champion, Nicolo Canepa, and David Checker, brother of Carlos Checker, of course, former World Superbike champion in their team. And we've already told you about the Honda Endurance Racing team that are in action this weekend as well. They brought Yoni Hernandez in for this weekend. If we were to make one slight point, Dre, and again, we hate to be negative, but we can kind of see what the Endurance World Championship has tried to do. It's kind of what the Endurance World Championship on four wheels has done with their super season in making their blue ribbon race the finale to the season, as the Le Mans 24 Hours will be next year at the end of the super season, to crown the super season champions. And this year, obviously for the last few years, that's what the Endurance World Championship on two wheels has done. But as it kind of had the opposite effect, in that the actual finale to the championship and the champions being crowned on Sunday night will kind of end up taking a back seat to the eventual winners of the race.
Yeah, it kind of feels that way. And it's a shame, really, because with this race, the regular World Endurance Championship contenders are now most likely going to be scoring only minor points in a silly, in a super season format where the last round carries the most points. It doesn't help where that's concerned. And I actually kind of feel bad, because they're not going to fully benefit from the system, because the new entries are most likely going to try and go for the win. Of course they are.
And they have more factory spec equipment on board than the actual World Championship teams have.
Exactly. So it's, I feel bad for them, because they're not going to take full advantage of this, you know, this bigger point system for the final round. And because they're fighting for minor points, it's not going to make as big a difference in the championship fight. So, yeah, it kind of almost makes the last round a little bit more redundant. I don't like to describe the 8 hours like that, but yeah, it is a problem. It's not helpful. It's not ideal for the championship to be that way. If that's how they're going to treat the 8 hours, they should make any new entry exempt from scoring championship points for the final round. That way, you could still have the regular contenders fight for the big points while ignoring the wildcard entries that want to win this highly prestigious, you know, one-off all-star sort of event. Because the way it is right now, it's a little bit unfair towards the regulars who were taking part in all the other events that year, and not these the big factories that are treating this as a showcase event that it is.
Yeah, I misspoke earlier when I gave you the figure. It's 35 points, not 38, on offer for the winners of this race, which means it is a straight fight this weekend for the title between GMT 94, the reigning champions, and FCC TSR Honda. But with the FCC TSR Honda squad having a 10-point lead, that's actually a bigger lead than it sounds. It doesn't sound like a big lead with 35 points for the winner, but these teams are unlikely to be scoring particularly big points, as Dre's mentioned. So that 10-point lead might already be enough for the FCC TSR Honda to win the championship this weekend. I mean, all they'd have to do, essentially, we were talking about this off-air before we started, when you look at the point system as it is, if that FCC TSR Honda squad finish in the top 10 and get 11 points for 10th, that means that the GNT 94 team would have to finish on the outright podium this weekend to beat them to the title, which they're not going to do. And to be fair to GMT 94, they finished sort of 8th or 9th last year and won the championship, and they had their celebration. It was a weekend of celebration for Yamaha, given that they won the outright race with their factory number 21, and their 94 team in the regular championship took the title. So everyone won if you were Yamaha. But it's probably going to take a backseat this weekend outright to the race itself. But we will update you next week on who indeed does win the championship, as well as the main story, which will be the race itself. Suzuka 8 Hour takes place in the early hours of Sunday morning. Make sure you do watch some of it. I know it's a very, very difficult time if you're based in Europe or based in the UK. And even so, if you're based in America, it's going to be taking place just as you're going to bed. It's going to be sort of starting at roughly sort of 10, 11 o'clock at night in the United States, and then running until sort of 6, 7 in the morning. So it's not an ideal time for most of us that are either participating or listening to this podcast. But whatever happens, we'll break it down next week. And it is one of the great races in motorsport, particularly on two wheels. So it is well worth watching at least some of it, and getting an idea of what it is. And I've said it before on this show, that sight of the race coming to a close at near enough dusk in Suzuka, yes, with all of the with the packed grandstands, because it is an absolute sellout at Suzuka for the 8 hour. And just the spectacle they make of it at the end of the race is a special, special spectacle for motorcycle sport. So do try and watch it. It is going to be a brilliant event, and it should be an absolutely titanic battle, particularly between the star-studded squads from Yamaha and Kawasaki this weekend. Whatever happens, as I mentioned, we'll break it down next week on episode 71 of Bike Life here on Motorsport 101. We'll have a full review of the Suzuka 8 Hour, and we'll look ahead to the Thruxton BSB round and the Czech MotoGP, which one of us two might well be going to next weekend. We'll get the last words from Dre before he heads over to the Czech Republic to watch the race himself from trackside. Before all that as well, he's got another podcast to record, and that is episode 153 of Motorsport 101. Hopefully this won't be a little bit cathartic for him. Hopefully it will be cathartic, because surely this is a race, if history is any indicator, Dre, that Sebastian Vettel's bound to win.
I don't know anymore, man. Like, I don't know, okay? It's the Hungarian Grand Prix.
I know it's easy
weekend
for me to say it as a non-Vettel fan, but I think he'll win this weekend.
He's the bookies' favourite at 2-1 to win this weekend. I don't know where they got that idea. But it's honestly, this is the first weekend where I feel that legitimately any one of the top six can win. This is a track where Red Bull tend to go very well around. They're not going to lose as much time on the straights as they have on other circuits.
Merck have only won once in the hybrid era.
Indeed. That was Daniel Ricciardo in 2014, and that was a race that was affected by Lewis Hamilton at the back.
Mercedes won once in the hybrid era, and that was 15 with Hamilton.
Yeah, exactly. So it's an unpredictable track, and you know, there's a chance of rain this weekend as well. There's all sorts of potential shenanigans that could be going on.
even forgetting what happened last weekend, when you're the fan, I'd take it from me, from back in 2009 when Jenson Button was going for the title, when you're a fan of the driver who's in theory got the best car and has got the best chance of winning the championship, the last thing you want is a wet race.
Nothing to upset the form book, please, and thank you. No, I think you're absolutely right. I think that it could go to any one of the top six this weekend. I think it's going to be very close. On paper, I think Vettel is the fair favourite, but it would not surprise me if Daniel Ricciardo or Max Verstappen came through this weekend at all. I think Red Bull have the potential to be very strong here. And Lewis Hamilton's won here, I think, 5 times now. So, like, he loves it here. He loves the Hungara, and he's always got here. So yeah, like I think there's a lot to potentially stand here for. This could be the closest race of the season so far. So I'm really looking forward to it. And whatever happens, we'll review it on episode 153 of Motorsport 101 with me, King, and RJ, whatever happens. As well as I believe IndyCar back this weekend, that Mid-Ohio as well. They're in Mid-Ohio, and yeah, it's Dixieland. That might be a problem for the championship where that's concerned, given that Scott Dixon has won 5 times in the past. It could be a problem. Just throwing that out there. But IndyCar Mid-Ohio and the Hungarian, we'll cover with a full review of both races on episode 153 of Motorsport 101 around this time next week.
Yeah, as well as episode 71 of Bike Lab, as I mentioned, we'll break down the Suzuka 8 hour. Will Suzuka be turned green for Team Green and Kawasaki, or will Yamaha do it again? Or can Honda reclaim their own circuit, having not won there for 4 years? We shall see. Next week we will review it all here on Bike Life Motorsport 101. But that was episode 70, a weekend dominated by Mustache Mountain. Josh Brooks taking the victory and kissing that mustache goodbye. We will see you next week.